We're going to start talking a lot about thyroid and adrenals and how they connect today, in particular a little bit of a focus on Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I know many of you are very interested in as well, and how the adrenals work with that or why we care. A lot of people, in hearing my background, sort of wonder how I got interested in thyroid and adrenals. When it comes to the adrenals, naturopathic physicians, of which I am one, have been treating adrenal imbalances for many, many, many years as part of our therapies. But I became very interested in adrenal and thyroid work actually after working with my cancer patients, because when you've gone through cancer care, you often end up with both adrenal and thyroid problems, especially if you've actually had chemotherapy, but even any prolonged illness. So we're going to start initially by talking a little bit about thyroid disorders and making sure that we're all kind of on the right side, kind of the right page. So we're going to start here. Thyroid disease is often hiding in plain sight. A lot of people don't know they have it, but it is extremely prevalent. When we look at people around the world, we actually find 2 to 3% of the population, about 10% of women after pregnancy, have thyroid problems. So this is actually a significant problem. We're talking actually about 20 million people in the U.S. have been diagnosed with hypothyroidism or thyroid disorders, and 10 million women who have mild disease, about 500,000 per year. That was the latest numbers. I believe that number is actually growing, but that is actually the latest numbers. Undiagnosed estimates is almost another quarter of that at 8 million people. So there's a lot of people who don't know they have thyroid problems. And this is primarily a women's disease. It's 10 to 1, women to men. However, men are often undiagnosed and get missed a lot. And there's, when we go through the signs and symptoms, we'll kind of briefly just chat about that. The average age of people who are diagnosed with thyroid problems tend to be in their mid-50s. About 10 to 20% of women in their mid-50s or around the age of menopause will actually be diagnosed with some sort of thyroid problem. And for the most part, we're talking about hypothyroidism. And there's risks, of course. We have surgical risks and traumas, head injuries in particular, and we are actually seeing traumatic head injuries like concussions actually be a big factor for why you might become hypothyroidism or hypothyroid. Family history, there's many generations of which you see generation upon generation where every woman in the family has low thyroid problems, for instance. Radiation exposure, medications, as we start using more and different kinds of medications and combining them, we actually are seeing those. And different congenital conditions like Down syndrome puts you at increased risk for thyroid disease. So we're to take a moment to take this slide in, but I always think it's good for people to know what parts we're talking about when we talk about thyroid disorders. And some people have said to me, like, Allison, this is quite a lot of biochemistry, but I figure all of the people that are interested in taking half, you know, an hour out of their lunchtime in the middle of a Thursday are people who are pretty educated and they want to know what's going on with their body. So we're going to talk about the real biochemistry of it. So in the thyroid or pituitary gland, which is that structure up at the top left-hand corner, you actually have the pituitary, which is, looks like an organ, but is actually kind of a collection of blood vessels. It's actually very fragile. And you have thyroid response hormone that produces a stimulus that goes to the pituitary, which is the dangly bit there, called thyroid, and produces a hormone called thyroid stimulating hormone of TSH. And that goes to the thyroid gland. That's the butterfly-shaped gland that's in the base of your neck. And that gland will produce two hormones, T4, which is thyroxine, and T3, which is tyrosine. Those hormones are very active, and so if you just let them be free and doing what they wanted to, you wouldn't get very much to your big toe. All of it would end up basically going to your head. So as a result, what the body does is it gives it a parent, so to speak, or a binding globulin. So thyroid binding globulin is a protein that holds hands with your thyroid hormone, the active thyroid hormone, and makes sure that it gets a chance to go to every cell. So it goes to every cell in the body and is handed off to that cell, and then that cell will take T4 and convert it into T3. So T3 is the active guy, T4 is an inactive guy, and thyroid binding globulin is what's kind of holding hands with it to make sure that your brain gets as much as your big toe does and your fingertips and your heart. When you have enough thyroid, it will turn around and go back to the blood vessels in the pituitary and allow the pituitary to sort of take a sampling of the bloodstream to see if there's enough thyroid hormone in that sample. And if there is, which there thankfully usually is, then the TSH will turn off. And this is called a negative feedback loop. So thyroid stimulating hormone, another way of thinking about this, that I think works pretty well for people, is if you are a boss and the pituitary, the brain is the boss, and the thyroid gland is the employee, and the thyroid hormone is, say, articles they're supposed to write. If your employee is doing a good job and writing articles or doing work as they're supposed to, then the boss is happy and just occasionally checks in, makes sure things are going well. But if the boss is seeing that the employee is actually not doing their work, they start doing what? They start sending emails, and then they start coming down and visiting you in your office, and then they start maybe stopping by every day, and then they start threatening you. And what happens is that if the employee gets to it, then the boss gets happy again and calms down. But if the employee is not doing a good job and there's not very much work coming out, then it's going to start yelling, right? The brain starts yelling, the boss starts yelling. And so one way to remember this is why when your TSH is high, your output of thyroid is low. It's the opposite of what you think. So people with low thyroid actually have a high TSH, or a high yelling by the brain to try to get production from the thyroid gland out. Okay, brain's not happy. So I think it's just a good analogy to sort of work with as far as the output, because it's always a little confusing to people. Now, when we talk about symptoms of thyroid, they have actually not been found to be specific to thyroid disease. So some people say, oh, well, I've got this symptom, that means I have thyroid problems. And the answer is no, that doesn't work that way. In fact, groups of symptoms have been associated with a higher rate of diagnosing thyroid problems, but no single symptom. So what are these low thyroid symptoms? Well, fatigue, that's usually the number one symptom that people will complain of, but dry hair, dry skin, hair loss, weight gain, heavy, irregular, painful periods, problems getting pregnant or staying pregnant, hoarseness, depression, constipation, aches and pains, in particular in the wrists and the ankles. And those often are worse in the morning and then get better as people kind of get warmed up. High blood lipids, that's cholesterol, high cholesterol. Slow thought processes, just can't come up with the words, just can't come up with, you know, what they were going to say next. Cold intolerance, edema, and, of course, fatigue. Again, it's the overriding thing. With the cold intolerance, being cold and not tolerating cold are the big symptoms. So this is the person that it's, you know, 90 degrees outside and they're wearing a polar fleece coat. So signs are signs that other people might notice if we were to examine you. And signs are kind of sometimes a little surprising. So hypertension, not low blood pressure, but actually high blood pressure. Bradycardia means your heart rate is really slow. Your hair can change texture and be very coarse or very wiry. You can get swelling around the eyes. Okay. Yellowing of the skin, in particular, the palms of your hands can be yellow, and that has to do with beta carotene and vitamin A, turning to vitamin A and breaking down in the skin. With thyroid problems, you can't break that down, so you get kind of a buildup of that in the skin. Carpal tunnel syndrome, that was, again, that sort of that wrist and ankle pain problem, and delayed reflexes. You might have heard that one way that you can evaluate thyroid is by doing a reflex study at the ankle and seeing whether someone's ankle kind of bounces back at a certain speed, and that has to do with the reflex of the thyroid. Thyroid can be any size or texture. It can have nodules. It cannot have nodules that are not particular. And unusually, very, very rarely, you'll find someone who gets diagnosed with thyroid because they have such bad constipation that their colon is a problem, or their heart gets really big, or they actually end up with congestive heart failure. And I did actually see a patient in my office who once had congestive heart failure from low thyroid. She had been low thyroid for years and had just never gone to the doctor for like 30 years. So it was not a good thing for her. So these are all the different types of thyroid, and it's just good to have everyone on the same page because I might use these terms. And because you guys are interested in thyroid, you're going to be reading about it and you're going to be talking to your doctors. So I think it's helpful if we all use the right terminology. And especially if you're researching, you want to go ahead and see that this is what they're going to use in the research articles. So one's called overt hypothyroidism, and this is basically no one has a question with it. Your TSH is high, your T4s are low, and you have symptoms. And that's actually not a common way to diagnose someone with low thyroid, but it's sort of the classic low thyroid symptom picture. Subclinical hypothyroidism is much more common, and that's when your TSH is slightly elevated, but your T4s and T3s are normal, but you have symptoms. Sometimes as we've gotten more educated as consumers and we ask our doctors to do additional testing, it confuses doctors who aren't familiar with where T4 and how T3 and T4 react to being low thyroid. And so sometimes what happens is they see a higher TSH and a normal T4 and T3 and think, oh, well, you're okay. But remember how we were talking that the TSH is a yell from the boss or a yell from the brain saying, hey, there's not enough work going on. Basically says the brain isn't happy regardless of what the T4 and T3 are doing. So that's called subclinical hypothyroidism. And then I'd actually like to propose the third category, which is called functional hypothyroidism. And many of you might be in this category. And we're going to talk about how this can be a situation of thyroid, but this may also be a situation of the adrenals. And that's where TSH, T4, and T3 are all normal, and yet you've got symptoms. Things aren't right. And so a lot of people today are going to fit in that category. If you're listening, that may be what's going on for you. Causes of hypothyroidism, the most common cause is Hashimoto's, which is chronic lymphocytic thyroiditis. Isn't that a mouthful? But basically the immune system attacking the thyroid. And we're going to talk, I think, really there's two kinds of Hashimoto's. I think there's kind of the chronic low-grade smoldering fire, which is more of the chronic autoimmune thyroid disease. And then you have sort of the acute Hashimoto's where someone gets a fever and their neck swells and it's very quick and out of the blue. And that's the more kind of classic Hashimoto's, but less common. Iatrogenic is when you've had Graves' disease and they treated you and so now you have thyroid problems. And postpartum, it's about 10% of women 6 to 12 months after you've had a baby are at high risk for having thyroid disease and autoimmune thyroiditis, and that's because of the effects of the immune system. So if we look, this is a triangle that was actually, I love this, was actually drawn by an endocrinologist back in the 1800s, and it's really this whole triad of thyroid, adrenals, and the sex hormones, those are the gonads, and how, if you think of this as like a flat disc, that as one side of that triangle goes out, or one point of that triangle is not working well, the other two start trying to compensate for it. And there's that interplay amongst them all. And for this situation, I put the pituitary in the middle because that controls, of course, all three of these sections. But we actually could have put things like blood sugar in the middle. We could have put insulin in the middle. So you can sort of put a lot of different things in the middle as to how they're all balancing around that. When we look at thyroid and the adrenals, we're looking at things like steroids and adrenal diseases and that interplay between thyroid and adrenal. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But let's talk a little bit about thyroid antibodies for a second. The thyroid gland, like in the thyroid gland, is basically made up of bunches of follicles. So these are like little, I don't know, I think of them as little balloons. And in these little balloons, we have ping pong balls filled with thyroid. And so on these balloons, we have a structure called the thyroid peroxidase. And this is an enzyme that helps concentrate iodine. But this is a problem because you can have these immune cells that are actually out attacking something else. But lo and behold, they wander by and they see the thyroid peroxidase and they think, huh, that looks kind of familiar. Let's get that. Okay. I hope everyone's appreciating the anatomics. I love this stuff. So it releases when we attack this. We pop the balloon, right? We go ahead and release a bunch of what's called cytokines. And these are chemical messengers that tells the body, like, hey, there's a problem here. Come get it. Come mop up this problem. We're attacking something. Okay, so we're talking about all the things that call up to the immune system. We also, because we popped that balloon, released a bunch of T4 and T3. So this is what happens with thyroid antibodies. You get destruction of the thyroid follicles. So we've popped the balloons. We've released all of these T4s and T3s. Of course, when we do that, right, we're going to have a lot of hyperthyroid symptoms, but then we're going to heal this area up again. We're going to patch the balloon up with duct tape, right? But the problem is we keep popping it and patching it with duct tape. After a while, the follicle just doesn't work the same way. And that's how some people with thyroid antibodies become Hashimoto's, become hypothyroid over time. There's just so much scarring or so much duct tape on the balloons that the thyroid hormone just doesn't get out anymore. Okay. This is also why people who have high antibodies are actually feeling terrible, because those cytokine messengers that are released when we pop that balloon, they go ahead and say, hey, I don't feel well. I've got a cold. I've got a flu, right? It's the same messengers that are going out. So the higher those antibodies, we used to think once they're high, that's all you care about. Oh, they're high. That's it. But now we know the higher those antibodies, the more inflammation, the more chemical messengers are out there, the worse people feel. So that's why it's good to keep an eye on those thyroid antibodies to make sure that they're coming down. And once they're high, they take a long time to come down. I've seen it take years for them to come down. So it's just something you kind of keep plodding away at. But it is why people with thyroid antibodies feel worse, even with exactly the same TSH and exactly the same T4 and T3. It has nothing to do with the thyroid. It has to do with these inflammatory cytokines. So these big messengers. So what kind of things trigger that? As many of you have been reading, there are many autoimmune factors and things that trigger it. A lot of viruses. And if you look at those viruses, Coxsackie, Yersinia, E. coli, many people might go, oh, E. coli, isn't that something that happens in the gut, or H. pylori? They are. They are all things that happen in the GI tract, and that's because thyroid and GI tissue actually have a lot in common. So you also see a high cross-reaction with wheat, which is the main protein, is gliadin, and other people who have other autoimmune diseases. So a lot of GI sort of immune reactions, the body will start looking for other things that look like, say, wheat, and happen across the thyroid tissue and go, oh, that looks enough like what I'm attacking in the stomach. Let's attack this thyroid too by accident, right? So one of the ways we're going to help treat this is actually try to reduce the GI side effects. And that's why you see recommendations to do things like try a gluten-free diet. And really, it's not just gluten-free. It's just try to eliminate any food intolerances you have, because there's an autoimmune reaction there. It's seeing something in your stomach and going after your tissue. So maybe if you reduce things in your stomach that it's reacting to, that it will reduce reaction to the thyroid. Doesn't always work, but it's worth a try. You want to keep your TSH very low, generally less than 2, and selenium has been found to be very, very helpful for reducing these antibodies. You also want to maybe be cautionary about glandular thyroid hormones, and a lot of people might have tried like Nature Thyroid or Armour Thyroid, but you do want to be cautious with those. Sometimes the glandular portion in those, instead of making you feel better, can actually stimulate more thyroid problems and more thyroid antibodies, so you do want to do that. And you want to reduce stressors and balance cortisol, which is what we're going to talk about here, and so that's what we're going to do next. Okay. Nutrients that are involved in thyroid, before we read this, is iodine, tyrosine are the main things that make up thyroid. But you also have zinc and B vitamins and selenium and iron involved as well. But let's talk about the adrenals. Okay, the adrenals, Ad meaning on top of, renal meaning kidney. These are structures that sit on top of the kidneys. They're very small. Your kidneys aren't that big. You know, they're pretty small, and they're very, very important. They are what I consider a tier one hormone. In other words, if you don't have your adrenal glands, you can die very easily if you are not taking care of them, replacing them. They produce a lot of hormones. They produce from their sections. This is kind of a cross-section if we cut it in half. They produce the hormones cortisol. They produce DHEA and DHA sulfate. They produce epinephrine and norepinephrine. Many people know epinephrine as adrenaline. And they produce your sex hormones. When a woman goes into menopause, these little tiny glands on top of your kidneys have to take over and make all the other hormones that they're missing. And why you care about adrenals is if you have thyroid problems, you have adrenal hormone issues. Remember that triangle. If your thyroid has stopped working, something's getting you up in the morning, something's getting the kids off to school, someone's getting you off to work, and that's your adrenal gland. Now, when you replace the thyroid, that helps, but it doesn't totally take over everything. You still have the adrenals, and sometimes the adrenals are like, oh, thank goodness you're finally doing your job. I can go ahead and take a break now. And that's, of course, where you can get into trouble. So severe adrenal disease is what most people think of and what, frankly, most doctors think of. We think of something called Cushing syndrome, where you get too much adrenal stimulation. You get high cortisol levels and you get high weights. You get abdominal stretch marks, not from pregnancy, just because you just wake up and have them. And you have a moon face, in other words, a very round face, and also what's called a buffalo hump on the back of your neck. And that's fat. And so, you know, this can happen very, very suddenly and obviously be very distressing for someone. If you've ever had a patient or a friend maybe that's been on prednisone or you yourself have been on prednisone, especially long-term, you can see some of these symptoms appear. Addison's disease is the other way that doctors think about the adrenals. And that's when you actually have no cortisol production. You get weight loss and you can actually turn brown. People look like they have a tan, but it's not a healthy tan, not a healthy tan. And you get pigmentation. You can run fevers and low blood pressure. And in fact, you can die of Addison's disease if you have no cortisol in a pretty brief period of time. These are both really extreme examples of what can happen to the adrenal glands. And this is the way most physicians think about the adrenals. You have Cushing's, you have Addison's, or you're fine. To me, what I tell my patients is, this is how doctors used to think about diabetes a long time ago. 25 years ago, you had type 1 diabetes, or you had type 2 diabetes, or you were fine. Now we know that we have lots of shades of gray, right? We have things like metabolic syndrome and syndrome X. We have prediabetes. We have hyperinsulinemia. So we have all these shades of gray that happened years before and are associated with symptoms year before you ever become one of these extreme of type 1 or type 2. Well, the adrenals are the same way. It's not like they're working perfectly and then all of a sudden they go Cushing's or Addison's. Yes, that does happen. Just like Hashimoto's, you can get a cold or flu, a viral infection that can trigger you to go one way or another. But for many people, we think that there's actually a long process of shades of gray that move you closer to one end or the other over time. When we think about these shades of gray, one way to think about it is what's called relative adrenal insufficiency. And this is commonly being coined as adrenal fatigue, and James Wilson coined that term. Relative adrenal insufficiency, I think, makes a lot of sense and is how it is actually researched in the medical literature. And it basically says, relative to the same stress, you have insufficient adrenal output. In other words, same stress comes in, instead of making a certain amount, it's a lot less. The people that are really, unfortunately, spurring a lot of the interest in relative adrenal insufficiency out there in the physician world, unfortunately, is our soldiers that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. There pretty much isn't any other situation that is as perfectly designed to absolutely destroy someone's adrenals than being in the military. So We're going to talk about that. Okay, so when do you test it? Well, if you have symptoms of adrenal problems, if you have taken your thyroid hormones but they haven't fixed you, you know, you're still tired, you're still dragging, before starting thyroid, interestingly, if you look at your insert on any thyroid medication, it actually recommends checking the adrenals. And I will tell you that less than 1% of doctors will ever tell you that they should test your adrenals before you do your thyroid. Okay. If you've ever had a chronic illness, or you currently have a chronic illness, and if you've ever been on steroids and have not felt well since, so you've done a period of prednisone, especially if you were on low doses for long periods of time or high doses for long periods of time rather than short for short periods of time. The adrenals, the longer you sort of suppress them by being on steroid medication, the harder it is for them to recover. So saying that, you want to make sure that your thyroid is actually fixed. And the reason I bring this up is because when they've done studies and they've looked at, okay, who has thyroid problems, and they've done blood work on those people, what they find is about 50% of patients actually have inadequate thyroid medication, either hyper or hypo, when they've been tested. And so what we're talking about is actually your TSH is around 1, and you can see this actually graph, I apologize, I didn't cite it, is actually from the Australian Thyroid Association. They have this wonderful chart here. And it basically says that after 3, you just don't see very many people walking around with thyroid disorder. So the peak of where people should be is 1 to 1.5. And so if you're taking supplementation for thyroid hormone, you want to be in that category as well. Many people's labs will report up to 5 or 6 as being normal, and I have seen many patients who have a TSH of 4.5 or 5.5 and said, oh, you're within the reference range, you're fine. No, and especially if you have Hashimoto's, your level really needs to be less than 2. I think that as we start, you know, there's a whole argument going out in the world, and it's mostly an argument because there's so many thyroid problems. And rather than say, oh my goodness, why are we seeing so many thyroid problems, the argument's getting like, well, maybe we're over-treating it. I think the truth is we are seeing more thyroid problems. We have a lot of chemicals that invade it. But when you take thyroid hormone, you really want to be in this 1 to 1.5, which is where the majority of the population is. You want to feel as good as the majority of people, right? Some people actually need to have levels less than 1 in order to reduce their antibodies. And once again, this is because you want to make sure before you start tackling or at the same time as you're tackling the adrenals that your thyroid is really optimized. So how do the thyroid and adrenals play together? So here's my little schematic of the thyroid, right? TSH going to the thyroid gland. And it's going to go ahead and produce majority of T4, about 80% as T4, and about 20% as T3. And T4 and T3 are being converted in every cell into at T3. Now the adrenals are producing the hormone cortisol. Okay, cortisol does a couple of different things. That's the problem. It inhibits or blocks the conversion from T4 to T3. So it slows that down. And at the same time, it goes back to the brain and it says, hey, you don't have to ask for too much, the TSH. So it tones down the TSH. It says to the employer, look, dude, I know that your employee is not doing a very good job and not putting out very much homework, but, you know, don't ask too much right now. And everyone says, well, why in the world would the adrenals do this? Well, the adrenals were not meant to deal with, like, this situation is not meant to deal with chronic stress. This situation is meant to deal with starvation. And if you're starving, you're a caveman person, and you're in your cave starving to death, the last thing you want is your thyroid hormone and your metabolism to be going full tilt. You want to slow it down. Otherwise, you're not going to make it through the winter. So what the body does is it basically says, go into hibernation, thyroid. Chill out, calm down, we're going to slow everything down here because we've got so much stress going on. We're going to slow everything down and go into hibernation because that way we're going to make it through the winter. The problem is for some people, winter is lasting years and years and years, and it doesn't feel so good. So what are symptoms of adrenal fatigue? And I'm going to coin and use both of those terms, okay? Adrenal fatigue is fatigue, right? You're tired. And sometimes to the point of being what I call couch bound. Like, you can get off the couch, but I always ask my patients, okay, if I took away all your family and all your obligations, and you could just, you don't have to make yourself do anything, what are you going to do? And many of them will say, I wouldn't get out of bed. And some people can't get out of bed at all. They just stay on the couch all day. You know, going out to pick up their kids tires them out for a whole day, and it can take days to recover from any sort of big outburst of energy. Problems balancing blood sugars, especially getting too low, being really cold all the time, having allergies, being anxious or nervous, having lots of stress, feeling stressed, and immune problems. Well, boy, doesn't this look a lot like our symptoms of low thyroid? And this is what I, this is why I'm so excited to talk to you guys about, because I see many patients who are really manipulating their thyroid hormones and increasing them and wanting to increase them and taking really high doses of thyroid hormone and not getting the response and going, well, but I've taken this thyroid and I've taken this thyroid and maybe I need the glandular and maybe, you know, my doctor put me on this dosage, but I've gone ahead and doubled it. And the answer is, that's all fine and good, but sometimes it's just another different hormone. You know, sometimes it's just something else that you need to try. And many times with thyroid, it's the adrenals. So when I talk about balancing blood sugar, this is what optimally everyone's blood sugar looks like. You eat a meal, it goes up, it comes down. It should keep its blood sugar balanced for about 4 hours, okay, so that you eat about every 4 hours. This is what happens if you live, like I did, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Twinkies, Ding Dogs, Dr. Pepper breakfast, right? So your blood sugar goes really high, and your body goes, oh my goodness, that is so much sugar. What am I going to do? And that is very stressful on the body. So the body puts out a lot of cortisol, and a lot of insulin. Okay, and then the insulin allows that blood sugar to drop really quickly, which, of course, makes you feel terrible as well, which is also really stressful on the body. And then your blood sugar goes actually below baseline, too low, which is cortisol's main job is to kind of keep it stable. So then, once again, cortisol needs to come in. So one of the things that we find is that you want to keep this as evenly base as possible so that it reduces the cortisol from having to try to jump in every once in a while. Okay. One of the ways to do this is to go ahead and balance this meal and to slow down your blood sugar so it's not so up and down is by adding proteins and fats to your diet. So let's talk a little bit about testing and how do you know your adrenals are a problem? Because I can say symptomatically, if you're listening to this and you have thyroid problems, you probably have adrenal problems. The question is, how badly off are you? So we can test blood work, and many of you may have asked your doctors to do that, and they say, okay, I'll just do a cortisol blood work. But it's not very helpful, okay? It's rarely used in research. Because it really only shows up if you've got Addison's or Cushing's, which is those extremes, right? Otherwise, if I'm stressed about blood work, and believe me, I hate having my blood taken, if you come at me with a needle, I'm going to get stressed. My cortisol is going to go up. So it's not particularly helpful. You can test cortisol in urine, which you can do with a daily rhythm, or you can do with a total 24-hour collection where you collect all the pee that you make in 24 hours, or you can test cortisol in saliva, and this allows for the evaluation, once again, of the daily rhythm, which is called the circadian rhythm, or just a single nighttime sample. And all of these, urine and saliva, are very well established in the medical literature for looking at cortisol as the best way, because you're not poking anyone, so there's no increase in those values because of that. Okay. This is how you do a saliva test, and this is what it looks like. So you get a big tube and then little tubes that you collect throughout the day. So usually when I have people collect, there's no right or wrong, you have people collect first thing in the morning and then before lunch, before dinner, and before bed. So that's one way that you can kind of do something. Or you can have someone do urine and they can pee on the strip or pee into a cup and dip the strip. And once again, in the morning, lunch, dinner, bedtime, and then that gives you kind of a circadian rhythm. But we're going to look at some samples of what this looks like to have people's cortisol rhythms, and this is these are saliva results, because I have to say, for most people, I really like the saliva results that people get. I think they're really nice and accurate. It's a nice way to do it. So this is just some graphs of different people's things that I think more on the adrenal spectrum. I tried to choose ones that are going to be more typical of what, if you guys tested your cortisols, what you would see. And this is throughout the day, and you can see the red line sort of the top of the line, the top, you know, 80%, and the yellow line is the bottom 20, and the green is kind of where most people average out. So you can see this person starts off in the morning with a lower value, low normal, but okay, kind of okay at noonish time, gets a little high at around 6 o'clock, which is actually really typical, right? You're getting stressed, maybe you've worked out late in the afternoon, running home, get the kids, get dinner, maybe to evening activities, and then crashing until 11 o'clock at night. It's actually low normal. This is actually not a super unhealthy adrenal pattern. The cortisol is a little low normal in the morning, and that would definitely give someone problems, you know, maybe getting out of bed. They're just really a little tired. By the end of the day, they're definitely done. But they probably feel best at 6 o'clock when they're rushing around and that cortisol is actually high. But let's look at some other samples that are maybe more extreme. This is another sample of someone who did their adrenal, a 49-year-old who did an adrenal one, and I just made it into a sample report. So none of this information is correct, okay? It's a quote been taken away from a real person. And you can see this person's cortisol. Do you see, if we look at the graph down below here, that the cortisol in the morning is actually below the yellow. So it's actually below that bar graph, and then it stays low normal, and then it comes way up at that evening time and nighttime. It's what we call a flattening of the cortisol curve, and you'll hear that in the literature. People will talk about people flattening their curve. Basically, it's almost the same value all day long. This person doesn't feel good until the levels go high. So they're too low normal in the morning, and they're too low normal at noontime. And then they sort of get a burst up. So this is your night owl. This is the person that's like, I can't even think about anything until 6 o'clock, and then I get my second wind, and then I'm doing all these projects. But then they try to go to sleep. Forget it. They can't get to sleep, and then they're dragging themselves out of bed the next morning. So you're really kind of flat all the time. And this is very typical of someone who has been dealing with adrenal fatigue. And this is very typical from anyone who's been diagnosed with low thyroid as a result. This is the same person done after they started treatment. And what you can see is, look, their cortisol in the morning came way up. Okay, they're still a little normal at noontime, but then they're also low normal in evening and night. And they have, in general, a much more dynamic pattern after their cortisol. And as a result, this person is now going to be able to sleep better because they are reaching a high in the morning and dropping throughout the day, and overall have a much healthier circadian pattern. Here's another example of someone that is not Addison's but might be couch bound. So this is someone who really never has a normal cortisol level, ever. And this person, it can happen so slowly that this person could be have very many symptoms that are very similar to Addison's, but if you drew their blood, their levels are going to be okay. In other words, they don't have Addison's, but they're kind of pre-Addison. This is the person that has a stressful event, and they just don't recover well. It may take them days to recover. They try to exercise, and they're going to feel absolutely terrible, and it may take them several days because their adrenal puts out just so much more and can't do anything about it. So now you've tested, you know you have a dream. Now what? Like, what do you do with this? You can test, you know, but now what do you do? You've got to find someone who can understand adrenal issues. And the beauty of dealing with the adrenals is there's many practitioners who are very interested in this now. It is definitely in the medical community, the conventional medical of allopathic community. You are seeing doctors becoming more interested, frankly, because many of them have some of the worst adrenal patterns I've ever seen. Okay, so they're interested because they don't feel good either. But you also have a lot of pharmacists that are interested. You have nurse practitioners that are interested. You have acupuncturists, chiropractors, naturopathic physicians. There's many, many people who are really studying and really trying to determine the best way to treat the adrenal. So if you haven't found that person that first time, don't give up. Just keep asking and finding someone on your team. Do your reading. There's some good books, and I've got a couple of them to start you with. But do your reading about adrenal fatigue and start your healing with lifestyle changes. It's so easy to say, well, I just want to take a pill, but I'm telling you, it doesn't work that way with the adrenals, and that's partly why it's taking so long for the medical community to turn around and how to think about it. There just isn't really a pill that fixes it. So the first thing you want to do when you talk to your doctors is recognize that not all doctors believe in it. And I put believe in quotes because we are talking science here. It's not a belief system. But some doctors do still think about that. So write down the symptoms that you're experiencing and keep a calendar. Say, like, I did this activity on Monday, and, like, I couldn't move on Tuesday. Okay? Keep a calendar. Write it down. It's really hard to go backwards and say, how was I feeling on Monday? You know, frankly, what did I have last night for dinner? I don't know. So how I felt last week, it's just not going to happen. So you have to do it every day. You don't want to become kind of hypochondriac-like, but you do want to at least put down, like, you know, this is how I felt, and this is maybe how my energy scale was, and this is what I tried to do, and this is how I, you know, I didn't have that happen. You want to start some lifestyle changes. These are things that don't need a doctor to help you with. Acknowledge that if you keep on doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. You got to do something different, okay? That means sleep. We have such a backwards association or backwards way of thinking about sleep in this country. We sort of think if you were working the longest hours, how many all-nighters, how tortured are you? Basically, how many vacations days did you not take last year, that this is a good thing. It is not. It is really bad on your adrenals. So sleep, sleep, sleep. You've got to prioritize it. And when people say, well, how much do you need? I don't need that much. Research says that most people need an average of 8 hours a night. That means there's occasionally the person that needs 7 hours, but there's many people who need 9 hours, 10 hours. Most people, if you're needing more than 10 hours, there is something else going on. But, you know, it's not uncommon that people need 9 and 10. Kids, yes, kids can have adrenal problems. There are children who do have adrenal problems, even very young. And kids need sleep. This is how, if you start your kids sleeping, that you will actually help prevent them from going through adrenal issues later on. You've got to get your blood sugar balanced. For many people, that's going to relieve a huge amount of fatigue. But so you've got to keep your blood sugar balanced. You've got to get the proteins and fats up, and you've got to watch the simple carbohydrates. As your adrenals heal, you'll handle the simple carbohydrates, the grains, et cetera, much better. But initially, people don't handle them very well. So you've got to get those proteins and fats to kind of even that out. You've got to figure out how to handle the stress. You've got to reduce what you can. You can't, you know, you can't stick your kids out the door and say, honey, you know, you're on your own. So you got your kids, you've got your pets, you've got to live those, but you have to figure out what kind of stressors you can control. You know, can you take 5 minutes every day, for instance, and say, start your morning with, like, your cup of coffee or tea and just reading a book for 5 minutes before you start the craziness of the day? Because sometimes it's really about mentally tuning and slowing down your life rather than changing what you're actually doing with those stressors. Okay. Getting out into nature, looking at things in nature, looking at the trees, looking at water, can reduce cortisol levels by half. So everyone can get away from your desk at work, go for a walk around the block. Look outside the window, you know, and eat your lunch. If you're eating at your desk, turn the chair around, look out the window, look at the trees, and basically just get present. The other thing you can do is 10 deep breaths. 10 belly breathings will automatically shift your nervous system and reduce your cortisol level. So these are all things you don't need a doctor for. Obviously, supplementation, I know people are going to want that information, and so I'm going to put it here, but this is in no way a recommendation for, like, this you have to do this or you have to do this. And there's going to be different dosages that are right for everyone. But, you know, vitamin-wise, vitamin C, B vitamins, essential fatty acids, and vitamin E, these are the building blocks of cortisol. It is made up of fats and B vitamins, especially B5 and B6. So making sure if you're going to take a multivitamin or you're going to take a B complex, like making sure that you're really putting our priority and getting a good quality one. Herbally, there's lots of things that can help the adrenals, and you often find these together. You find something called adaptogens. These are things that help the adrenals adapt to different stressors, things like ashwagandha, Siberian ginseng. There's some more stimulant herbs like American ginseng and licorice, which you have to use a little bit more cautiously, but that can be helpful because if your cortisol is really low, you've got to try to bring it up. Okay? You can use things like adrenal glandulars. These are basically beastie bits, things that actually help fuel the right proteins that you can take that will go into the adrenals and be used to make the adrenal hormones. And in rare cases, you may find someone who, definitely with Addison's, but even someone with relative adrenal insufficiency that might benefit from some hydrocortisone in order to actually replace cortisol. I think, you know, we're kind of winding down here, but one of the things that I really think is a big deal is that you really need to recharge and rejuvenate. I ask my patients, if you want to heal yourself from adrenals, you can't sit on the couch. You can't take time off of work and just lay around your couch. It just doesn't work that way. You have to find something you love to fuel you. You have to find something that fuels your passion. And that's why you'll heal your adrenals. So I always tell people, if you were on a desert island, once again, I take your family away, I take all your bills away, and I put you on this desert island, what are you going to do to keep yourself busy? What kind of things do you really love to do? It usually is something creative, almost always. It's usually painting or drawing or sewing or writing or cooking that really fuels you, that when you do that, the time will just pass and you don't even know where it goes to. That's the stuff you have to do, and you have to prioritize it. It has to become important. If you're healing from an adrenals, it has to be something that you can do this for 30 minutes once a week. You know, you can find the time. And if you can't find it on your own, but you know it's good for you, then sign up for a class. Pay money to go to a class and make yourself go and nurture your passions, because it is going to fuel and heal your adrenals more than taking any other pill will do it. And you've got to find it. And some people are like, well, I'm not good at anything. I didn't say you had to be good at it. I said you had to like it. So try to find what recharges your batteries. Okay. Some recommended reading, Adrenal Fatigue by James Wilson, is something that a lot of people will read and go, oh, my gosh, he wrote this about me. And he is a very, very a great writer and has some very funny cartoons. The Cortisol Connection deals a little bit more with high cortisol. It's by a researcher named Sean Talbot. For some reason, Dr. Talbot doesn't like, he's a PhD, doesn't like saliva testing, so I always recommend this with sort of that caveat. I don't get it. I don't really understand why he doesn't, because frankly the research is all done on saliva, but he does have some good information about how cortisol works, and so for that reason, I do recommend his book. It's a good place to do. But, you know, I just want to thank you all for listening. I'm going to take as many questions as I can so that we can try to do this. Obviously, I can't give you treatment advice, so I'm sorry if you've written saying, I'm doing this and it's not working. I'm sorry because we can't do that here, but I can certainly answer all the questions that I can to try to help out as many people as possible. So I hope this has been very helpful. Okay. So just a few questions. Okay. So the first question I got was someone who wrote, you know, my thyroid peroxidase is 3,000. So what would that be? If you have thyroid peroxidase, has different labs have different ways of monitoring thyroid peroxidase. Some labs will put out a range where the normal is 0 to 20. Some labs will put out 0 to 50, and then there's another range at 0 to 150. In general, people's levels truly to be negative should have a level less than 10. So if you're level 3,000, you got some thyroid antibodies going on. That's definitely autoimmune thyroiditis. And then as far as like whether you're overtly hypothyroid or subclinical, for most people they're going to be subclinical. Maybe TSH is starting to creep up, but T4 and T3 are probably normal. And you don't always have to be on thyroid hormones to treat those antibodies, but having those antibodies around, remember that the hormone, as they pop those balloons, those inflammatory messengers, those chemical messengers that go out that try to get your immune system activated, which is the same kind as happens with colds and flus, are going to be activated. So you're going to not feel as well as someone who doesn't have thyroid antibodies but has the same TSH and T4. So that's kind of the issue there. When people say, like, how high is high for thyroid antibodies, like I said, levels truly less than 10 are negative. Some labs will cap out at 3,000. Honestly, I think if your level is greater than, you know, the range, let's say your range goes up to 150 in the lab you're tested, once your levels are over 500, you just have ridiculously high antibodies. And if it's higher, 3,000, if it goes from 3,000 to 2,000, that looks like such a big number jump, doesn't it? But it's actually moving in the right direction, but it's kind of the same number. So don't get too freaked out if it really kind of drifts back and forth at that time. Someone asked, if they've been tested and have negative results for gluten, should they still go gluten-free? I think that's a great question. If you've been tested for celiac disease, and yet you still have symptoms, yes, you might try going gluten-free. Most of the tests that we do for gluten will only test one part of the immune system, and for some people, they react to either a different protein other than gluten, because there's other proteins in wheat, or they're acting with a different part of the immune system. And what do you have to lose? Try some new foods. You might like them. Rice crackers are good. But try it for 6 weeks. It can take up to 6 weeks to even see difference. So, you know, I would go ahead and do that. Okay. When people ask, avoiding glandular thyroids, are my speaking up medication like Synthroid? I am not. Synthroid is not a glandular thyroid. Glandular thyroid is going to be something like Naturethroid, where or Westroid or Armour thyroid. They have T4 and T3 in them, but they also have glandular or porcine proteins in there. So that's what I'm talking about. There are also some over-the-counter supplements that have glandular thyroid in them. Synthroid. Compounded hormones can be made so that they actually don't have that glandular portion in it. And for many people with Hashimoto's, that might be better. Okay. There's questions about people. Someone asked, can you have a high TSH and low adrenals? And the answer, of course, is yes, you can. You can have both hypothyroidism and adrenal fatigue. Yeah. And the reason that it's recommended that you test the adrenals before starting thyroid is because if I start taking thyroid, I speed up the metabolism of all of my cells. I turn everything on. And what happens then is I'm going to metabolize out my cortisol. But the problem is if your adrenal glands can't make it as fast to keep that level up as high as quickly, I can go from having normal to low adrenal levels to actually low levels to no adrenal function, and that's why it's recommended to test. Let's see here. I have people said, I'm picking through people, a lot of people asking personal questions, so I'm trying to find ones that are good. Can lifestyle changes you mentioned help increase low cortisol? Yes. If you start sleeping, that helps recharge the adrenals. If you take like your B vitamins and balance your blood sugar and you take stress off your adrenals, that will improve your cortisol levels. That will increase your levels. Okay. Does low cortisol cause issues if people have tested their reverse T3? That's a great question. We don't think that low cortisol causes reverse T3. Reverse T3, I didn't talk about today, is basically another way that your body has of slowing down. It's a part of way that the body does of decreasing that T4 to T3 conversion. And it's generally high cortisol that does it, high stress that does it. So if you have low cortisol and high reverse T3, it's probably because of all the other factors that have gone on previous to being diagnosed. Let's see. As far as someone asked this, I'm going to remind people that if they do want to go ahead and listen to this again and have questions, that will actually be, it is being recorded, and that a link will be sent to them, so you can listen to it. Apologize for all of my mispronunciations, et cetera, that happen as I get going. Question about weight gain, and is weight gain common, especially with adrenal issues or thyroid? It is common in both situations. Weight gain is common with people who have low thyroid because your metabolism, half of your metabolism is controlled by thyroid at a cellular level. So it has nothing to do with what you're exercising. It just has to do with how many calories you burn when sitting there. And if your thyroid slows down, you burn less calories. When you have low adrenal issues, low adrenal function, you actually can gain weight because you want more carbohydrates to try to make yourself feel better, and you don't balance your blood sugar well. So that combination causes a weight gain a lot, and if you have high cortisol, that will definitely cause weight gain as well. Now, high cortisol is kind of that Cushingoid effect. People ask the specific blood test for thyroid antibodies. I apologize. There are two. Thyroid peroxidase antibodies, or TPO, is the most common. Someone asked if I could talk briefly of how do you add menopause into this picture, and you are exactly right. Boy, it is commonly a time when all three of these problems happen at one time. And boy, I can create quite a complicated diagram very quickly, but let's just say that you add sex hormone imbalances on top of this, and if your poor adrenals are having problems making cortisol, which remember, if you don't have, you die. Let's just say that making the estrogen and progesterone that it's supposed to make to kind of keep you going in menopause is the adrenal's last priority after you've hit menopause. And so, yeah, it's not very common. People asking, I think this is a very good question. I'm going to take two more. Asking, do you need to be off of thyroid to test your adrenals? And the answer is no. If you have been put on thyroid hormone, you should not go off your thyroid hormone to test your adrenals. There is no need to do that. It is hoped, obviously, that you are on your thyroid to restore normal levels, and so you don't want to stop that and set your body into a tailspin and then see how your body responds to that stressor. It's not going to go well, so I would certainly not do that as well. And I'm going to choose one more question. I apologize, but let's say, should you start supplementation of any of these things on your own? I think that's a great question, and I would really urge you to find someone to help you. It's really hard when you're in adrenal issues and thyroid to try to figure it out on your own. It's really helpful to have someone who can look at your symptoms and say, I know you think it's because of this, but I think it's because of this, and let's try something different. I did provide links to supplementation and things like that just to kind of start the process, because for many of you it's going to take a while to figure that out. But certainly that's going to be the best way to do is to do it. But you can certainly start the lifestyle things on your own today. You can make the decision to sleep a little bit more tonight and to manage your stressors and help balance your blood sugar. And for many, many people, that's going to start turning your adrenals around. And once again, Be creative in your life and have fun. So thank you very much for taking some time with me today. I really appreciate it. I hope everyone's gotten what they wanted out of this, and have a great day.